From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
You've probably heard the expression No Mow May in recent years, a campaign borrowed from an effort in the UK meant to increase diversity by leaving lawns unmown for the one spring month. But is that the answer for U.S. gardeners? More in a moment on managing our lawns in May and beyond with ecology in mind, but first these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Walcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
My guest today is Mary Phillips, head of Native Plant Habitat Strategy and Certifications at the National Wildlife Federation, a conservation nonprofit founded in 1936 with chapters today in every state. And our topic is the lawn and how we can manage it in the smartest ways possible and not just in the month of May. So thanks for making time to join me, Mary. Good to talk to you.
You too, Margaret. And thank you so much for having me today. I'm really excited.
Yes, well, I've been excited to see you guys sort of putting out more information about subjects like the lawn, because that's been such a hot topic for gardeners lately. And I wanted us, before we get started, I wanted you to just sort of tell us, what do you do at National Wildlife Federation? Tell us just a little bit about your assignment, so to speak.
Oh, sure. Thanks so much. Yeah, I started at National Wildlife Federation 10 years ago to head up our whole area that's really focused on getting people to do more ecological gardening. And actually, it is under the umbrella of the Garden for Wildlife Certified Wildlife Habitat program that was started 50 years ago. Actually, we're in our 51st year. So it's been a real privilege to carry this legacy forward and involve so many millions of people that are providing food, water, cover, places to raise young, and doing all that with native plants and sustainable practices. And we have over 300,000 certified wildlife habitat sites now. So it's really grown, and we've really moved into giving much more education on the importance of the percentages of native plants you want to include to really do the kind of change for both wildlife and actually helping people have healthier, more approachable and beautiful community spaces.
Yeah. So as I said, the lawn's been a hot topic, that's for sure, yeah, in recent years, and not just for gardeners, really for all homeowners. You know, as more awareness about sort of the ecological wasteland that so much manicured grass, especially managed with chemicals and mown with gas guzzling machinery, you know, what that represents really, and not even to mention the water used to keep it green, sometimes in the most preposterous parts of the country where there's no excuse for that. So, you know, I was interested to see a data point from National Wildlife Federation the other day that you publicized. It said in 2023, 32.3 million people indicated that they were converting a portion of their lawn to native wildflowers.
Yes. So that data point comes from a partnership we have with the National Gardening Survey. And we've been surveying around this data point and others for the last, this will be our seventh year with them. And this is is 2023. Those were the number of people, but actually households that indicated they were converting a portion of their lawn to native wildflowers. And that's part of calculated from the full number of households based on the U.S. Census Bureau data. And this then was the number that indicated this transition.
Well, that certainly means that you're getting someone's attention.
Yes. Yes. And it has been growing. It has been growing along with other data points that 1 in 4 people are actually purchasing plants because they benefit wildlife. So we're really excited. And 1 in 3 purchasing actually native plants to do that role.
Right. How much lawn is there at the moment? I probably know this number somewhere in my addled brain, but how much lawn are we talking about in the United States?
We are talking about a significant amount.
I think
and
it's tens of
40
millions.
Million, well,
40
yeah,
million.
Sorry,
yeah.
40 million. Sorry,
yeah,
just like wow. I blanked out for a minute. It's 40 million acres of turf grass, and approximately 60% of those are in private gardens.
Right. So we can, as gardeners, make a big difference. And that's what the messaging has been increasingly in recent years. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned in the introduction, in 2019, I think it was, a campaign called No Mow May, which is very catchy, mm-hmm. was introduced in the UK. And it quickly was picked up on in certain media here and so forth. And because it sounds good. It's like, oh, if I don't mow for a month, that's going to be really good. And it's going to increase diversity.
Yes.
And oh, wow. So what do you in the National Wildlife Federation think of stopping mowing for a month as a way to counterbalance the impacts of, you know, that vast green monoculture?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so we've really been kind of pushing and leaning into what we're calling Grow Beyond No Mow May. And the reason is that just to your point, in certain areas, this might make sense, but it's not a universal approach. Many areas don't have the kind of growing green turf seasons, for one thing. The other thing is that it only is beneficial if the lawn has a substantial number of non-invasive wildflowers that actually benefit pollinators. If you're just not mowing monoculture turf grass, then nothing's really happening for the wildlife.
You're just getting longer monoculture turf grass.
Exactly. Which sadly can attract ticks and other kinds of pests that you don't want. So it's kind of, you know, it's not a universal solution. And the other thing that does make sense, you know, that people have really leaned into is that you are reducing carbon emissions for that window in the spring if you don't mow for the month. But again, you can do that. You don't have to use a mower if you've actually, you know, translated some of your lawn into this either lower native wildflower ground covers or other types of native flowering pollinator patches.
Yeah. Last year we had strange weather where I am. I'm in a rural county in New York State in the Hudson Valley. And so I have a lot of, it was never a lawn in the sense it was old farm and stuff like that. So it wasn't planted as whatever, bluegrass or fescue or whatever. So it's got lots of violets and it's got lots of other things.
Yeah.
And over the years, I've probably added, you know, medium white clover and this and that. So last year, the way the rains came, I didn't mow for a while in the spring. It was like, and suddenly, because sometimes when it's really wet, it's just a mess to do that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, this looks just so great. And look at everybody's buzzing around and everybody's happy because there was that stuff, like the violets, for instance,
exactly.
are just a real hit with many, many, many different organisms, animals, whatever. So, you know, but that's not the case, like you say, in your conventional lawn. And and giving back parts of it is even better, right? So what are some of the ideas? You just also, by the way, you just hinted on, maybe we should, before we talk about like getting rid of some of it, managing it more smartly. I mean, I wish they had a campaign about like no fertilize ever.
Yes.
How about no pre-emergence herbicides ever?
Yes.
How about that? Doesn't sound very snappy
or
clever though. I'm sorry, I'm not very clever.
No. It's exactly, you're exactly right. And I think that's why there was such appeal around this. And again, the intent and the concept is awesome, but you really need to put it into practicality. So, you know, there are specific things that you can do, I'll confess my patches of lawn, I do have some, sound very similar to yours. So I do not mow those areas as much either, because you do see the wildlife. You see, not only the bees, but where you have low growing wildflowers in an area, those bees and insects that some of them are host plants for other insects. So you're also supporting birds in those areas as well.
Right.
But I think that's the other really big thing about having, you know, these 40 million acres. The way you manage them is so dependent on chemicals and water use. And that is another reason to, you know, replace with plants that are naturally occurring and have co-evolved in your area that are native, so that you're not, you know, sucking down those resources from the watershed, or also putting in those chemicals into the watershed. The other really thing about turf lawn is that the root system is very shallow, and so it doesn't do anything for stormwater runoff.
Right. Right. So, it doesn't really have that benefit at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. So there's that. And then there's the, when we are going to mow, whatever schedule we're on, we can change some of our mowing habits too. Yeah. And I, you know, I've been playing around. 30 or so years ago, I did my first, what I call unmowing exercise, where I picked an amoebic sort of big area above the house on a hillside, and I stopped mowing it just to see what would happen. You know, I didn't really know, but I'd been out in the Midwest and I'd learned something about prairie stuff. And don't you know, some little blue stem sprang up and I was like, oh, huh, I could make this like mini tiny prairie. And it was kind of fun. And over the years it's evolved and so forth, and it changes all the time. But I've been experimenting more and more recently with sort of unmown areas, in other words, without planting anything, seeing what comes up. And boy, it's strange. Like in certain areas, lots comes up. We were just talking about some things like you and I both have, like the violets. But some places I'll get like erigeron, I'll get fleabane, you know. But then across the yard, if I unmowed or an area, I don't get that. Do you know what I mean? It's
yes. And unfortunately, sometimes you get invasives that
that's what I was going to say. I bet that's the risk, right?
It is. It is absolutely. And right now there's a number of invasives in my area. I live in Maryland, and this is in other parts of the country too. There's something called lesser celandine, and it's really just a nightmare. And, you know, it just by not maintaining and staying on top of those, that is a really tricky one to get rid of. But if you're, you know, if you just left an area unmown and you're kind of not paying attention or not monitoring it, these invasive types can come in there as well.
Right. So what I've been doing is just sort of playing and watching, and I'm pretty good with plant ID, and I have a lot of, you know, my field guides, and now of course we all have virtual field guides with our phone. And, you know, and so that's when something emerges, I'll be like, what's that? And you know what I mean? I'll key it out, and, and it's kind of fun to find out what you potentially could have if you let your grass grow. But again, mine wasn't a planted lawn out of a bag, so that's a little bit different. But we can, if we are mowing, we could mow at a different height, which would mean that we would mow less frequently.
It would be less frequently. I mean, keeping it maybe at like 3 inches or a little bit higher also reduces the amount of water that's needed, but it kind of keeps it somewhat tidy. And I think you know, it's kind of managing that space with, again, I would recommend incorporating other beds and other areas around it. But if you did need a green space, you know, either where kids play or whatever, you can, you know, leave it go a little bit and do kind of the no mowing, but still doing it, you know, routinely. So it's like I said, around 3 inches or higher, and just really absolutely not using any chemicals on it. I mean, I think that's really, really key.
Right. And I think an electric lawnmower or you know, battery lawnmower.
Yes.
The batteries have gotten so much better. My first one was many, many years ago and like the first generation. And besides the greenness of them, boy, is it nice not to have all that damn noise.
It is.
Do you know
it
what I mean? They're so much quieter.
It is. They're wonderful, you know, depending on the size of your space. And even if you don't have that, I mean, for several years when I was younger, I used the push mower, you know, the old rotor one. Those are so awesome. And actually, it's very gratifying to see that chop away as you're pushing around. Again, it was a small suburban area, so it was easier. But, you know, there's a lot of different options like that. But you're right. I think what they've done with the electric mowers has just been phenomenal with the battery life.
Yeah, it's great to see the technology advancing. All right. So we're not advocating, I mean, you know, there are practical reasons to have something you can walk on, and turf is something that you can walk on. So to get from here to there across the yard, to have an entertaining space or a play space, it's fine to have those areas. We're not sort of saying all 40 million acres, you know, because again, it does serve a purpose. What we're saying is maybe look critically at your turf spaces and say, huh, this one could transition to that, or this could be that, but no, this one I really want to keep because it does this function for me. And you know what I mean? Really look at it more carefully. So what are some of the kind of possibilities of what we could do instead?
Well, sure. So first off, for those that do have a significant amount of lawn, for the last 12 years, we've been celebrating Garden for Wildlife Month. And this Garden for Wildlife Month, we're challenging people to just identify a patch of that lawn and transform it into some wild flower native plant. Plantings for their area. That would be a first step. And then in those areas where you are going to be keeping the lawn or you want that walkable space, is to look at some of the really low growing species that are out there that could be used as a ground cover. In shadier areas, you could use a native moss. You could use some other different types of carex grass is a good species to look at some of the low growing versions
sedges.
Of that. Yeah, the sedges. Yes, absolutely. So there's options to kind of also make your yard space more interesting with all these different textures and colors that these variety of plants have.
What I loved was to learn, I guess it was about a year ago, at Mount Cuba Center in Delaware, the Native Plant Research Center, where they did the carex trials. When they were done with the normal length of the trial, they left the test beds in place to continue mowing trials on them long-term and walking trials on them long-term. The ones that looked the most adapted from their earlier trials to being walked on and mowed, they're going to keep testing them and see what happens. Do any of them sort of hold up as a, quote, lawn substitute? Because some of them are quite different plants from what's been cultivated as turf grass.
Yeah, they are different. Yeah. And they do have, you know, a center that's a little, you know, it is a little bit, it doesn't look like you know, the exact thing. So I think it's testing out. Well, also what would be native to where you live, I think is absolutely a key part of this. One of the ones I think they've found a lot of good experience with is the Pennsylvania sedge. One is one that, you know, it's kind of turfy in a way. It's still though in clusters. So it's not going to be exactly like a turf lawn, but it could be a good substitute.
Yeah. But I'm interested to see as they, you know, keep on sort of, giving us more info about how this looks and how that looks is kind of fun. So
It's a wonderful study, and they've been doing amazing studies on a variety of plants, also cultivars in that space.
So if people are willing to give back a bed, so they're say they can identify, you know, I don't know how much, you know, even 8 by 20 feet or whatever, you know, even just a space, and they say, I'm going to give that area of green of grass back. We're talking about like smothering it with, you know, corrugated cardboard and mulch and planting right into it, or
So I guess I would recommend where you can pull it out or dig away some of that turf. That's ideal, because then you're also getting at some of the roots. It would be primarily, you know, pulling that away, you know, kind of slicing the top layer off deeper if you can, and then using mulch as a deterrent initially to keep those the grass from coming back and the weeds from coming back. The other thing is that once you start doing this and transforming this, is to plant densely. That really helps also keep the weeds and grass from coming up as well with the plants that you've selected.
So basically the program that you've been suggesting these years has been in this kind of promotion month each year is to identify an area and just make a small contribution each time, so to speak.
Exactly.
And sometimes it's easier to turn something into a shrub border or bed or whatever than it is to create a mixed perennial, an annual or herbaceous you know, symphony that yes. really works. I mean, perennials are a lot more work. They take longer. I mean, not that you don't need a ground cover mm-hmm. under shrubs, but I feel like shrubs, I don't know, they do a lot of work and they ask a lot less. And sometimes, and you know, you can get a lot out of them. I mean, you know, yeah. you get your pollinator, you get your flowering, uh-huh. you can get fruiting. You know, they can interest various animals in the ecosystem at different seasons. They can also obviously be structurally beautiful.
Yes.
They can have fall color, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there can be a lot of, I mean, best thing I ever did here when I first got here decades ago was uh-huh. plant like 40 winterberry hollies and oh, boatloads nice. Of viburnums and aronias. And so, you know, the chokeberries. And so, you know, yeah. it's like they've just been paying their own rent. I mean, and yes. then some. I mean, it's just like wonderful.
You must have a symphony of birds as well.
Oh, I have. Yeah, I'm like everybody's favorite stopover. Yes, absolutely. The flocks. Yeah. Yes.
That's
and they
wonderful.
Come and take them all in 5 minutes. It's hilarious when you see them strip, you know, yes. a bank of like a bed of like 10, yeah. 30-year-old winter berries. You know, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pieces of fruit, and they're all gone.
It's amazing. Well, and on that same kind of bent that you're going with the shrubs, I mean, the other thing is there's some gorgeous, taller native grasses.
Yes.
Like you had mentioned the blue stem, but there's, you know, switchgrass, and there's just a variety of others to look at that really provide kind of depth and texture. And what people don't realize is those obviously provide really great cover for birds and also materials for nesting birds. But the actual stalks of these grasses provide an area for hibernating or overwintering, I should say, bumblebees and other species of insects that are so critical to the variety of wildlife in the food chain. And that's something I think people don't really realize. They just kind of see that grass there, and they bloom in their own way, not all of them the same, but there's a lot there that people don't realize just within those grass ecosystems.
There definitely is. And with those hollow stems, as you're saying, there's a lot of stem nesting bees and other creatures that really can utilize them.
And it gives this amazing movement to your space with the wind and the colors. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And all you have to do is when you go look at some birds' nests, if you have any birds' nests being built around your place.
Yeah.
And look the materials they're using. And it's pretty amazing. It's like a real reinforcement of, you know, there nothing is garbage.
Yes.
Nothing is waste material, right? Do you know what I mean?
Right. It's it's all used.
Wow. It's upcycled and so cleverly. It's amazing. I love that. So I know one of the things that can happen when we want to change the way we manage our lawn, that I get a lot of comments when I do stories for New York Times columns or whatever about this subject. A lot of people will be like, well, that's all well and good and sounds right environmentally, but I can't do that in my neighborhood. My HOA, my homeowners association says we can't do that. Or my neighbors hate me and they say I can't do that, so I had to stop it. I think we have to keep in a constructive and positive way, keep the conversation open and push back about that a little. Now, Maryland, you're in Maryland.
Yes.
There was an important case in Maryland that came up thanks to one homeowner saying, no, you know what? I'm not going to erase my native plant front yard. Let's talk about it. Let's keep working on this. And ended up being a law now that the HOAs can't do that.
Well, yes. And that's set a wonderful precedent that's been happening in other areas. I was just on a call a little while ago with our Delaware affiliate, and they are working on what they're calling pathway ordinances to really help homeowners and HOAs understand that these things are okay. They can be there. And it's really to kind of push back like the Maryland law did on these various ordinances that people have put into without knowing over the years, you know, that are very rigid and don't allow people to have these natural landscapes. So, and we're actually collecting, there's a variety of ordinances and state laws that are actually really advocating for this kind of new newer leaning into and turning around a lot of these ordinances that have been in place in the past. So really excited to see that. But I think the other thing, though, just as a being courteous neighbor and a conscientious one, is you can use these spaces to educate others by having signage that show, what you're doing, that it's intentional. Again, we love our certified wildlife habitat signs because that helps people really understand what's going on. But even in that is to provide some structure. So even if you're removing lawn, you can still do a permeable pathway or something that provides structure and flow through your space, through the gardens. You can put in some, yard art or a bench or something that actually gives structure and texture to the space that people realize you're doing something intentional. And it's not just, throwing a bunch of seeds out there that, I mean, I like that too because it's fun. I like to see what comes up. I have a couple little experimental spaces in my own yard. Actually, early this morning, I was throwing some seed out there, but I think having those spaces either, having some parameters around them, and you can use shrubs or you can use the grasses. You can use, again, some dense plantings of similar plants to kind of define those areas and spaces.
Well, we've used up almost all of our
Oh.
time, but I'm so glad to speak to you. No, it's great. I could talk about this forever. And it sounds like you could too, so that's good. And I just want to say, with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com, I'm going to give links to a lot of the materials that you have on the website and the programs that you've been talking about, so people can participate. I think it's really important what you that last point you just made, Mary, about Doug Tallamy at University of Delaware calls it a cue for care. That there's a hint that someone's at work there caring about the place. It's not just a mess. And I think that's super important. But I'm really glad to connect.
Yeah, you
So
too.
thank you,
Me
thank
too.
you.
Yeah, thank you. And we have a lot of Doug Tallamy's Keystone plant lists on our website. We've been working with him, and our Native Plant Finder is something that he created with us. So
Yes, and I'll give
lots of
those links
resources.
too. Thank you so much.
Thank
All
you.
right,
So
well,
great to
enjoy
speak with you.
spring. I'll
Yeah,
talk to you
you too.
again.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, offering 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.